Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are joined now by Aaron Hughes, who is an organizing team leader for the IVAW, the Iraq Veterans Against the War. He did one tour during the invasion of Iraq with the U.S. National Guard, and the IVAW has come out with a statement about what has to be done now with soldiers who are being sent back despite their traumatization, despite post-traumatic stress, besides all the traumatic brain injury that many of them have suffered. And it is a war that that many people are questioning now in America about why it's still being fought and what we're doing there and how this thing is going to end and where it's going to go. The death toll in Iraq this year is the largest single death toll of all the wars we've been fighting here in the last 10 years. Over 370 people so far have been killed just this year alone. And Aaron Hughes joins us here. Aaron, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark. Thanks. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm really pleased to be able to talk to your audience.
Well, this is a very important issue here. I mean, I know that we do a lot of work on this radio program around veterans and veterans issues and with veterans from the war of my era, Vietnam, to the one we're stuck in now. So this is what you're calling for here. Let's take a little step backwards. Tell our listeners and viewers what IVAW is, for those who don't know it.
So today, Iraq Veterans Against the War announced our first strategic campaign. And what Iraq Veterans Against the War is, the national organization of GIs and veterans that served since 9/11. Most of us have served in Afghanistan or Iraq. And we call for three basic things: the full withdrawal of all occupying forces out of Iraq and Afghanistan, the reparations to Iraqi and Afghan people, and full VA benefits to all the returning soldiers. And today, like I was saying, we announced our first campaign. That campaign was called Operation Recovery, Stop the Deployment of Traumatized Troops. And it's really focusing in and honing in on our first and our third point of unity. And it's focused on stopping the deployment of those soldiers that have gone over there, that have done their duty, they've come back with the scars and traumas of war. And now the military, in its desperation, is saying these soldiers have to go back over. And even though in its own policies, in the DOD, it says it's not allowed to do it, it keeps sending them back over. And we're saying, you know what, doesn't matter what the military needs, GIs and veterans, we're still citizens of the United States, and we're still human beings, and we have rights. And we're here to fight for them and fight back for them.
It's pretty amazing here. I want you to describe in kind of a little bit more detail here for our listeners what Operation Recovery is and Stop the Deployment of Traumatized Troops. What you're saying is that hundreds, if not more, thousands of service members who have already served one, two tours, sometimes three, four tours, who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma, women have been raped while they've been soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, are being sent back despite these soldiers and sailors and Marines being diagnosed with these disorders.
That's correct. In DOD reports, they acknowledge that somewhere up to 60% of women in the National Guard and Reserve have been sexually assaulted.
60%?
Yes, 60%. They're dealing with military sexual trauma, and yet they're asked to stay in that situation, that systemically problematic situation, and deploy in that situation overseas. And, you know, I think that's a key issue. You know, anytime that trauma happens and we're not creating a safe space for those people to heal, I think we have to look at ourselves and talk about, well, what are we really trying to accomplish? You know, if we are dehumanizing our troops like this, how are we expecting them to fight for a democracy in another country? If we can't even, you know, have rights and respect the rights of GIs, how are they going to respect the rights of people in other lands? It's just a cycle of dehumanization.
I mean, 60% is a pretty shocking number.
Yes, it's an extremely shocking number, and you know, 17 to 15% of the soldiers that are deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq currently, they're in combat, are on psychotropic drugs. And there's a whole list of other statistics that are just outrageous. And our objective, really, right now, is really just to begin to expose. It's just to unpeel, you know, the layers of this onion and expose what's going on. Because the military doesn't want this story out there. The Department of Defense doesn't want this story out there. In a lot of ways, the government doesn't want this story out there, because it shows the fact that the the military isn't there about humanitarian relief or building democracy. You know, it shows that it's really there for other means, you know, and because if it can't even respect the humanity of its own soldiers, how are we going to respect the humanity of people in this, in these other lands? And I saw that firsthand when I was in Iraq. You know, I went over there thinking I was going to provide humanitarian relief. I went over there as a truck driver thinking I was going to bring food and water to the Iraqi people. And not once did I do that. And in fact, I was written up for passing out water to an elderly woman that was standing on the side of the road in Iraq in 120-degree heat. And I think, you know, like, that's when, you know, my process and transformation began, where I really started thinking about, well, what are we doing over here? And, you know, the government can't give us a clear explanation of what we are, what our mission is in Iraq and Afghanistan, any of the countries right now. And simultaneously, that's going on. You know, these troops are being asked to go back over and over and over again. We're saying enough is enough.
And I, you know, with 370 men and women who have died in combat in Afghanistan this last year, over 370, which is the largest number in any single year since we've been fighting these wars. When you compare that to 239 soldiers who have killed themselves in this last year, that you put out in your press release, 1,713 soldiers who have survived suicide, 146 more who have died from high-risk activities, including about 74, 75 men or women who have died from drug overdoses. I mean, these numbers are pretty astounding, and these are the folks that are being sent back.
That's right. You know, today we heard testimony from Jason Hurd, and, you know, he's 100% disabled through the Veterans Administration. In other words, he's not supposed to work anywhere, and he's on psychotropic drugs to maintain himself and his well-being. And soldiers that are on those exact same drugs and dealing with the exact same issues are deploying. Soldiers that he knows and I know are deploying. My unit, the 1244th Transportation out of Illinois Army National Guard, they just deployed back to Iraq last week. You know, I think that's a whole other issue, is the fact that, you know, the media and the way we talk about these wars is so repressed. You know, we're not even acknowledging that there are troops that are still deploying to Iraq. You know, despite the fact that we've drawn down the numbers, we're still deploying more troops there. And we have upwards of 40,000 soldiers there.
And the fact
and
that
a
we have
lot of them are dealing with these issues.
I mean, the fact that all of you are volunteers, either in the National Guard or in the Army, Navy, Marines, or Air Force, and the numbers are limited, they have to keep sending you back, or they wouldn't have enough troops to fight with.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, it's time that we really need to ask the nation and this government, you know, like, if we truly believe in these occupations, which it's clear that 70% of this nation doesn't believe in these occupations, and we're not willing to raise taxes or have a war tax to continue these occupations, then why are we putting undue pressure on these soldiers that sign up to defend the Constitution of the United States, fight for this country? We're putting all this weight on them so a very small group of people can profit. And that's the reality of the situation. That's a sad reality. But that's what I saw when I was deployed. And, you know, I think we really just need to look at, like, why we are continuing to perpetuate these wars. Is it really about our safety? Is it really about defending our Constitution? Is it really about defending the United States of America? I don't see that, not from my experience.
We're talking with Aaron Hughes, organizing team leader for the Iraq Veterans Against the War. He did one tour of duty in the invasion of Iraq with the U.S. National Guard. And he is representing the IVAW now that are calling for an end to sending traumatized troops back to war in Afghanistan and Iraq. They had a demonstration today and this ninth anniversary of the beginning of the Afghanistan war. We are honored to have him with us for this period of time. Aaron, could you tell us a website or a phone number people could call to learn more?
Yes. I want to thank you very much for having me on your show. Please, everyone, go to Iraq Veterans Against the War. Our website is IVAW.org. And I need to give a shout-out to CivSoul, Civilian Soldier Alliance. They have a website as well. They're a civilian ally organization that's really helping to build our movement of GIs and veterans and get all our brothers and sisters home so we can fight for what we really believe. Jobs and justice back home. So.
Brother, I appreciate your service to our country, and thank you so much for joining us, and keep up the fight.
Thank you.
Aaron Hughes, organizing team leader for the Iraq Veterans Against the War, with their work now to stop our government from sending back men and women who have been traumatized in that war with post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma. And the stat he gave, the DOD came out with today, is something for us to all stop and think about. 60% of all women in the National Guard have suffered sexual trauma while in the wars. Think about that as we take a little break here to go to our next guest. And we'll come back to that subject another day, but we couldn't go through this 9th anniversary without hearing from some of the brothers and sisters who have fought in that war and what they're doing and what they're thinking about today. And also about the Afghan and Iraqi people who are living through this as well, and hope we can come to some solution to figure out how we can find some peace in those areas and bring our boys and girls home and let the Afghan and Iraqi people live in peace. So, having said that, let me say we're about to switch gears. And we are joined once again. We're going to talk about this thing we have between our ears called the brain and how it functions for creativity in our society, which we've been doing a lot over the last few years. I mean, we do it all the time, many of us, but I'm talking about on this program, talking about it. We are joined here by Susan McSalmon, who is co-director of the Neuroeducation Initiative at Johns Hopkins University, who are co-conspirators with us just a few weeks ago, and now she's here in the studio with us. Dave Hess is not here yet, right? He's not. He's coming. He's on his way. A sculptor. Ed Connor is with us, professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. David Foster, assistant professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. And Barbara Landau, who is professor and chair of the Department of Cognitive Science at Johns Hopkins University. Well, Hopkins is just everywhere today. Welcome. Good to have you with us in the studio.
Thanks, Mark.
And you all can join us here as this conversation unfolds at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Susan, let's first talk a bit about this conference taking place and you know, what inspired you all coming on the show today.
Well, we're really excited about it.
I think that that microphone doesn't seem to be working well. Can you just grab his microphone and you can share that one? I'm sorry, until we can get this working. Just pull that over. I'm sorry.
How's this?
That's better. Now I can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having us. This is the brainchild of the Brain Science Institute. That's part of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And about a year and a half ago, we started getting an understanding that there were many people at Hopkins all over the university that were very interested in perceptual neuroscience. And they were doing some very interesting things looking at sensory systems. Marrying that to so many artists and folks interested in the arts at Johns Hopkins, we felt, let's bring this together. So very much we decided to bring together people that were interested in perceptual neuroscience and the arts to really try to understand what that alchemy was and how we could better understand how our senses really inform our emotions and our affect and what we ultimately think of as aesthetics and beauty. So on October 20th and 21st, we'll be bringing together a lot of artists and a lot of scientists, collectors, curators, educators, really interested in understanding how the senses work and how that really begins to inform how we interpret and perceive the world and what applications we may be able to dream of and conceive of and think about as it relates to our senses.
I'm curious, from the three folks in the room now who are all involved in neuroscience, and one of the artists will be joining us very shortly, David Hess, if you ever thought, Barbara Landau, that when you began your career in neuroscience, that it'd be taking this turn? I mean, this is something really, this whole world is not new, but the focus on it is relatively new in terms of really studying how the creative mind works and how it can, our understanding of all this can actually change not just the perceptions, but what we build and do.
No, I don't think I ever would have thought it would have taken this turn. But I have to say that one of the first books that I ever read when I was a graduate student was Lynch's Image of the City. Lynch is an architect, and this is a very, very well-known book. He wrote one of the first and greatest books about how architects create a city and how that is represented in the minds of the people that navigate the city. And that sort of set me on the path of being fascinated about how people represent space and how they represent especially the large-scale spaces around them.
But having said that, I'm curious, I'll just kind of chime in here, because I mean, I'm curious about that. I mean, just to let's kind of parse what that means. I mean, what you're looking at is how understanding that process can help us create, let's say, a place that can, a hospital that can heal better. I mean, is that what we're talking about here? on some levels?
So I think, you know, we don't want to overplay the idea that neuroscience is going to instruct artists or architects no, in any way in what they do.
Right.
And yeah, naturally people would react badly to that. I mean, I think the people that are going to get more out of this exchange are the neuroscientists. I think it's I think we're all interested in, you know, what events in the brain occur and how they give rise to what we experience subjectively. And aesthetics is just like a sort of the ultimate subjective experience. And we'd like to make that correlation.
Artists have been doing this forever. You know, artists are so intuitive about how to express emotion and how to communicate. So as Ed said, I think we will learn a lot from artists about how their processes work and how they interpret the world and how they create impact. So that's very exciting. You know, there's this whole field of translational science, and that's really what the Neuroeducation Initiative is trying to look at, is what do we know about the brain and about learning, and how can that begin to be applied and be tested in an applied way in other places? So in schools, at home, in the community, how can you begin to understand that? But we're really at the beginning of this notion of translational neuroscience. And I think bringing people together the way we are, you know, this is a very diverse group of people that are coming together. They
sounds
don't
like
talk
it.
To each other. And it's very exciting to find a common language and to start a conversation. Very often, I think we are in a soundbite world where it's, you know, red and blue and yes and no. And what we're trying to do is say there is no one answer. In fact, there are many, many questions that need to be asked, and there's a lot of conversation. So it's going to be a very interactive series of conversations.
I'm curious, though, what questions you're asking as neuroscientists here. What are you looking for? It's always great in a cocktail party to have a conversation between a sculptor and a neuroscientist, but what is that, you know, that could be the beginning of a bad joke as well, but what is it you're really looking for?
One of the things is we know that architects, like Susan said, they use intuition. That's what some of the architects we've been speaking to say. They use intuition in designing spaces for people, and we're really interested what the basis of that intuition is. If I was to ask an architect, which hopefully I will have the chance to do, what interests me is how do they choose what they think is going to be an effective building or an aesthetically pleasing building, or in the case of a hospital, do they think about such issues as what makes a building a recuperative or have other properties for its functional use? And even just more basically, what makes a building useful or popular?
What does that have to do with your work?
Well, what I work on and what similar scientists to me have done is we're interested in how the brain represents space. And recently there's been a lot of new findings on how the brain represents space. And the key to it all is that there are specialized systems in the brain for dealing with space. And we've only just begun to find out what that means. But there are specific circuits in the brain that represent spaces that animals and people inhabit, find themselves in, and have to navigate around. And for my part, I would love to know as much as possible about what that means about the basis of spatial navigation. And clearly, architects are using or accessing at some level knowledge about what makes spaces functional and efficient that I would like to know more about.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Barbara.
Well, just to follow up on
that.
Yeah,
please.
One concrete example is the way that an architect designs a building is presumably in part so that people will not only feel comfortable in it and be able to find their way, but so they won't get lost. Now, sometimes it is the case that we get lost in buildings, but it's of great interest to ask the architect, how would you design a building so a person wouldn't get lost? because a lot of what we want to know as psychologists or as neuroscientists is what happens to us in our brain when we do get disoriented or lost, and how do we recover our orientation. So I think that talking to an architect and finding out what kinds of signposts or what kinds of structures would promote not getting lost could actually inform our thinking about what it means to get lost when we are disoriented, for example.
Tom Kundig, who is the architect that will be speaking at the speaker series, also designs churches. And so we'll be talking about sacred spaces and how do you create sacred spaces. And I think that's very interesting, too. You know, spaces are designed for different purposes. So what creates an enriched environment in a school? What creates a safe space for home? What is a sacred space, regardless of religion? So we'll be talking about that as well.
I mean, does that have an effect, do you think, on how a space is designed, how it looks? Does that have an effect on our behavior in that space? And if it does or doesn't, if it does, let's say, does then that have an effect on, let's say it's a hospital, on the process of healing, the process of recovery? I mean, that's...
So it's a difficult question to answer, but I can give you an example, which is sort of an interesting example that actually the architect that we're talking about, Tom Kundig, who we're going to speak to, this is an example that he gave of something that we can really relate to on the science side. So many of the experiments into spatial behavior in animals involve trading off information about that the animal gets or a person gets from his own movements against the information you get from distant landmarks. So there's always this possibility of tension between information you have very close to you or from your own movement and information from distant views. And very interestingly, Tom had told us that one of the principles of design for, I think it was churches in Eastern churches was...
like Eastern Orthodox churches you're
talking
about?
No.
You mean Eastern as an Asian?
Yes, I think these I forget. I'd have to go back to him to ask him exactly.
Okay.
But spiritual buildings, mm-hmm. there's this principle which is have an entryway in which the person is sort of spun around and is moved around in a sort of a corridor that spins the person around so they don't know exactly where they are, and then you enter into a larger a high-ceilinged forum that will then evoke a spiritual sense that you see a large space, you see the distant landmarks. And that's exactly what we would do if we were trying to, in an experiment with to see the spatial abilities of animals, that we would try to disorient them so that we can then get their behavior to be governed by distal landmarks in an environment rather than being governed by the local cues. So there's this fascinating correspondence.
It makes, when you were saying that, I just chuckled. It makes me wonder if I'd like go to a church or synagogue, am I just being manipulated into my spirituality?
Exactly.
Or is it really there? Are they just putting it in the space and create the space to make us feel a certain way?
Well, there may be some knowledge there that we're not privy to at this point.
But that's a good point, because I think it's really important to say that understanding how the brain works and how sensory systems work is really to understand what makes us human and this notion of aesthetics and beauty, not to think about ways to manipulate behavior. And I think that that's not the goal of any of the research that's being done.
Well, I guess the reason I said that tongue in cheek, but not at all as a joke. I mean, if you think about ways that research like this can be used, it can be used in any number of ways. You know, I mean, if you understand how the brain functions during the creative process, and how that affects our activity, our brain activity, our neural activity, then you can manipulate that in all kinds of ways. When I was talking about walking into a church or synagogue or temple and being manipulated into spirituality, I was laughing, but clearly that's something that happens. you know, why we build churches with these great spires, and when you have to look up, and what the windows do to us, and what the awe of the place does to us. You walk into Notre Dame in Paris, and what it does to you is you walk through, even if you're not Catholic. If you're a good little Jewish boy walking in, it kind of hits you anyway, and you feel something because it's how it is constructed. And so that's, I mean, those are very real things.
And another good example is I'm sure that the spaces that children are in when they're in school matter a lot to whether they learn. So if you think about something as simple as scale, how big is the space you're in? How small is it? Architects have an intuitive sense about the right size space for a child of a different of different ages, and what kind of a space will make them feel presumably comfortable and want to interact with their environment. We as psychologists actually know really very little about how young children represent scale and how they respond to scale around them. And yet, again, I think conversations with architects can actually one could draw on their intuitions about the size of the space, the scale of the space, in order to inform our own investigations into how children represent scale.
Now, how does this interact with the other work that's being done? Let's say the work. I know you explained this on some levels at this conference as well, and we talked about this a few weeks back in another program, which was what we're learning about how one can learn, let's say through the process of creating jazz, and Lim's work on studying the brain of a musician as that musician is performing, right?
The improv work.
So, and it may have been part of the argument about how we use creativity to learn and how that can kind of maybe transform the way we teach our children. It might go on the fly in the face of all the testing we're doing, but that's another issue. How does that relate to this? In other words, is there a connection between that work, which actually might transform the way we learn and how we teach our children, to what you're doing with, let's say, architects and how you're doing building?
Well, let me make that link from Charles and Marielle's conversation a couple weeks back. So Charles looks at improvisation, and his work was looking at what happens when a musician studies a piece and plays it, what's happening
right.
in the brain
right.
versus what happens when someone's improvising in an fMRI machine. And what he saw is that in order to be being improvisational, you needed to actually turn off your sensor, the ability to monitor and to critique what you're doing. And so for us in learning, that's very interesting, the idea of being able to not be critiquing yourself, but to be able to really explore, create, truly create as you're playing or as you're making art or as you're learning. Charles will be one of the presenters at the summit, and he actually has three musicians that he's going to be working with. One is Mike Pope, who is a jazz musician, and he'll be talking about his process in terms of how he creates improvisation. Marin Alsop will be talking about conducting and about the nature, the physicality, and the improvisational aspects of being a conductor. And then Pat Matheny will also be there talking about improv. And I think Pat has done all kinds of experimentation with thinking about improvisation over the years. Well, we really feel like there's a very strong connection between how musicians play without this consciousness, with this very unconscious thinking, and how you can create some studies that we can look at with children in classroom where you're not asking them to perform to a test, where it's not direct instruction, where we're really opening it up to a much larger opportunity for children to experiment and to create and to use content in a unique way to create something new. And that's the definition of creativity, is making something new. And so it's understanding content, but it's the ability to be able to use that for critical thinking, for collaboration, for communications, for truly innovation. And I think, you know, you can take that one step further to 21st century skills and the need to really have innovation and entrepreneurs. And, you know, there's great information that says, you know, in our children's lifetime, they'll have 10 jobs. And that's amazing. But 8 of them haven't been invented yet. So we think creativity is a really important thing. And you can link it back to music and link it to improvisation. And there's quite a lot of work that's been done in music and more, almost more than any other sensory system. Music has been explored, and it's a real tangible art that we can really look at.
We're talking about the conference coming up from the Brain Science Institute, the science of the arts, perceptual neuroscience and aesthetics. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're taking a short break and come right back. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, you can go to www.umm.edu/heart or go to the Mark Steiner Show on the rotating banner and click on Maryland Hospital and see what they have. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'll do that a little later. I just want to welcome you back to the Mark Steiner Show. And we are talking once again about the synergy between the neurology, the study of our brains, and the arts, and what they mean, what the understanding of the process of creativity means for us all. Brain Science Institute at Johns Hopkins is sponsoring the Science of the Arts, Perceptual Neuroscience and Aesthetics, a conference coming up on October 20th at the American Visionary Arts Museum and other places as well. It's in a bunch of different locations. One of the people putting that together is co-director of the Neuroeducation Initiative, herself, Susan Mack Salmon. She joins us in studio, as does Ed Connor, professor of neuroscience, and David Foster, assistant professor of neuroscience, both at Johns Hopkins. And we're now joined by the sculptor, David Hesk. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. 410-319-8888. So, David, tell me for you what all this is. I mean, I know what you do, and I know your work, and it's phenomenal. But what as a sculptor, what does this mean to you? Why are you doing this?
It's a big mystery. I'm fascinated by the subject as well, and I'm really not sure what I'm in for, to tell you the truth. I'm anxious to share my work and how I go about a little bit of my process, but also listen and hear some of the things that some of the scientists have discovered.
But what do you? I'm curious. I mean, what this means to you? Though? I mean, what is the process between your work and neuroscience? Anybody else is a dancer, a painter, anybody in this world?
I think everyone has creativity in them, and I think for some of us, we're lucky enough to be doing that professionally and having been sort of nurtured through that process, both in education and maybe family and friends pushing it along. And I think when you're told that you're so creative or you know, you have an ability, whether it's in art or music or architecture, it's intuitive, but you also know that, like I said, other people share that. And I'm fascinated by how the things that I do seem to do naturally, other people can do as well, and maybe why they're not moving in those directions, and maybe what would cause them to do it. So I think it's about education, and it's also about trying to nurture more creativity.
I wonder, and this is not quite what you're talking about, perhaps, and maybe it is, but I'm going to throw it anyway. Do you think that we are wired for creativity? Or does creativity change the nature of how our brain works?
Yeah, so I think that gets at the essence of it. So it's amazing to me, and if you step back and think about it, it's truly amazing that people like David spend their entire lives creating things that don't have any, you know, clear utility. They're just there to be admired. And, of course, people pay lots of money to have him do that.
He hopes so.
Yeah. And why is that? So I think it's because of the way the brain is made for other purposes. We evolve. We've evolved this incredible visual system. It's one of the most amazing things the brain does, something that people have been trying to do for decades with computers. They can't do it. They try to create computer vision systems that can do object perception the way humans can, mm-hmm. and it can't be done. So it's one of the major systems of the brain. Complex to a level that we can't understand. We can't duplicate in computers. People like David are intuitively playing on that system, and they're creating things that evoke responses from that system that are incredibly special. We want to figure out what's special about those responses.
What do you mean by it evoked from that system? What system are you talking about?
So the visual system in the brain, it occupies much of the brain. It's made up of roughly 30 different areas that process different aspects of visual perception. So David is a sculptor, and I study the part of that that visual network, what's called the ventral pathway, that deals with object perception, with shape and color and texture, objects and scenes. So that's truly the part of the brain that that David is evoking responses from. It's a part of the brain that allows us to recognize our friends, understand all the objects in our world. We live in a world of objects. It's something that really makes up the content of our consciousness almost every minute of our life.
So, in that, what you were just describing here, it has a lot of potential to open up things that are very controversial and very dangerous in the process as well, it would seem to me. I mean, when I talked earlier about, when you can study these things, it can be used in a very manipulative sense, what you discover in this research, and that's this reality. It can be used in a very creative way to change society in a positive sense as well.
How is it dangerous?
Well, what I said earlier was it's dangerous if anything we do can be used the example I used was when you walk into a church and you see this, could be any place of worship, but a church, and churches are built, and were built especially in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, and still do today, in ways that create awe, that create a sense of wonderment and something larger than you. So in some sense, they instill the spirituality in you, even if you don't have it when you walk through the door. So in that sense, you're being manipulated on a certain level.
But that's a great example, Mark, where artists have already discovered this.
Right.
I don't think neuroscience is going to tell us a new way to make art. It's going to tell us something about why people make art the way they do.
And your point about creativity, I want to say yes, exclamation point, to everyone is creative. I think whether it's hardwired is the right term or not, I think creativity is something that is part of being human. I mean, we make new things as a species. We've made new things forever. What I think is so interesting is that we start to put people into categories. So David is an artist. And that means that if David's an artist, David's and the quality of his art, he's a good artist. He's a well-known artist, which means if I make sculpture, I must not be good at it. So very young, I stop making art because I'm not good at it, even though I'm creating. So as a culture, we've stopped recognizing creativity as being something that we all do, and we start to qualify it. And once you start to qualify it, kids in particular start to pull away from it, but adults do too. I love to sing. I have a terrible voice. Does that mean that I shouldn't sing? And so in our world, that's what we do. We end up saying, well, if you're not good at it, you shouldn't do it. And I think in some ways we end up repressing the creativity, which becomes innovation, which becomes change in our world. And so a lot of this also speaks to that.
So if you begin this process of conversation and observation and working with artists and other creative people and studying their brain waves and how their brain functions as they're doing their work, what does it tell you? I mean, what does it tell you in terms of what are you looking for? What are you looking for, not just scientifically, but what are you looking for socially, societally? I mean, what is it you're looking for?
An understanding of the brain is what I'm looking for. I've always been motivated by a philosophical interest in, how it is that some electrical events in this lump of tissue can give rise to everything we experience subjectively. And I think if we could really understand it, it would be transformative at a philosophical level rather than a practical level. Aesthetics, again, I think is sort of the high point of subjective experience. So if you could explain that, you would have explained something very important about human experience.
How'd you answer that question?
Well, I think it's we're hoping this will be a two-way street, because I think we'd like to think that the artists involved will be quite interested in not finding answers to how do they make art, but what's the context in which they're making art from a scientific point of view? Because like Ed said, they are manipulating whether it's space or sculptured shapes or whatever. They're manipulating these basic properties, which we're just trying to understand in terms of what the brain's doing. And so these two approaches have to meet somewhere. And we think that we're not going to get the answers, but by starting to talk to architects and sculptors and dancers and so on, we'll at least find out if there are common intuitions, common problems that will inspire both sides.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So I don't think artists are going to discover new ways to create, but I think the brain should be of great interest to artists in the same way the materials they work with are. I mean, the physical materials they work with are an intermediate step on the way to creating brain responses. So just the way you'd want to understand how to use your materials, anything that you could learn about the brain would be of inherent interest to artists, even if it didn't provide any kind of specific direction.
I think that's true, David?
I think we're all I think artists by nature are very curious people, and I think part of creativity is curiosity, that you're trying to really draw on the resources around you, whether it's if you're a musician, you're interested in all kinds of music. You're not just interested in your instrument or the type of instrument or type of music that you play. As an artist, I'm interested in photography, in architecture, and many different types of visual art. And for years, I've also been interested in science. And actually, the process of studying subject matter in science and how a laboratory works and how a research scientist goes through their process of solving a problem or investigating a problem is really not that different from what goes on in a studio. And so that there are lots of overlaps. And I think, what fascinates me is something that Ed said earlier is his whole career has been devoted toward brain research. My whole career has been devoted toward three-dimensional manipulation of materials. It sounds like a very obscure thing when you think about it in the world that, you would take a bunch of junk and put it together. It's fascinating to me that his research is not just about the brain, but it's actually about three-dimensional imaging in the brain. It's so specific.
It'd be interesting to see how this where this could actually go ultimately. I mean, I was thinking about a couple of things. I was thinking about what happens to what the brain does in movement if we're dancing. Dancing is like a fundamental activity and a fundamental spiritual activity as well as a sensual activity. I mean, it's something that is there, but it's in thinking about that in terms of also, let's say, the actor. When an actor embodies a part, and an actor has to take, if somebody's really acting and working at the craft, they have to leave the persona they're in and literally enter the being of somebody else, like you're manipulating a puppet from the inside of somebody else. What does that do to the function? I was thinking about a man who's coming on the show soon, I hope, Abu the Flute Maker, who's an amazing guy in the city. And Abu finds found objects, anything. He makes bassoons, incredible bassoons, for example, out of bedposts that he finds in the trash. But what happens to him when he's both creating that bassoon, what happens to his brain, and as when he begins to figure out how to play it and how to make that into an instrument? Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the...
And then what's the audience experience, too? So that's something that we'll talk about as well. What's happening when you are watching dance and when you're connecting to that emotive piece? We learn through our senses. That's what our senses do. And while we're such a culture of language, you know, there's so many arts that really move us that don't require words. And so I think that's something that we're very interested in, too, is really looking at all of the ways that our senses help us learn and this whole sense of growth through the arts.
Hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, so these other examples that you bring up emphasize the point that we make art that speaks to things that the brain does. So if you think about the truly amazing things the brain does that, again, are difficult to reproduce with computers. Movement, human movement. Mm-hmm. We can't build robots that can move the way humans can. We can't build a robot ballerina. Our language ability, of course, a major part of the brain. Sound recognition in general. This is what dance and theater and music speaks to. You've got this incredibly complex brain system that has such a rich variety of things that it can represent. That's what we make art out of.
Another thing I wanted to say is that, you know, we will be talking a lot about sort of what the brain does biologically, and we'll also be talking a little bit about sort of the cultural representation of all of the arts, too. So, you know, there's a real mix between cultures and what cultures think. Xiaoxing Wang is going to be talking about harmonic representation, and we'll be talking about some things that he thinks may be universal and things that are cultural. So we'll
what does
have
that mean?
A really
what
nice
would you,
mix.
Just explain what you just said.
So certain sounds may be universal to everyone wherever we live. And then music that we like in one part of the world may be very different than music that's pleasurable, that's aesthetically pleasing in another part of the world. Is there art that is more culturally satisfying to one group of people over another? So there are cultural differences in what we see as aesthetically pleasing, and then there also is a whole baseline of universal things that we think may be true. And so we'll be talking about that. There's certainly no definitive answer to that, but we'll begin to address, you know, what is human and what is universal to all of us, and what may be culturally specific too. So I think that will be an interesting part of the conversation.
I was thinking when you were talking about what the computers can't do yet in terms of mimicking human behavior and human movement, that I remember I read an article, maybe about 10 years ago I think this was, was about the growth then, and now it's grown exponentially larger, of chess games that are being created that can mm-hmm. beat you in chess. I mean, I've been beat many times by the frame across from me. But it's also the article also talked about that our digital world will have reached the human brain when it can create a game of Go that can beat a Go master.
Yeah, great example. Yeah, actually, terrific example, because chess is a very linear game with a very limited number of moves. So
right.
A computer can brute force its way through all the different permutations. Go, of course, is a 19x19 board. The number of permutations is virtually infinite.
Right.
It requires pattern recognition, the kind of thing that this ventral visual pathway does, to look at a Go board and realize what the next powerful move is. And so a terrific example of what computers can beat us at and what they can't beat us at. I think you're right that the very best computer systems for Go are like, amateur.
They may be able to beat me in a couple of games. They'd never beat a Go master, though.
No, not close.
Yeah. So you're going to say something? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say that we may forget that the things that that some of the things that the brain does that are things that we do without even thinking about it. So it's the things that are most commonplace in human experience, whether it's sort of seeing, recognizing a person or picking up an object or walking out the room or finding my way out of this building, they're all things that we take for granted. It's sort of interesting that artists are dealing with some of these areas, but they get singled out as being particularly good at dancing or particularly good at stimulating sort of visual senses and so on, but even making basically anybody who can walk around or recognize things or you know, deal with objects in an ordinary way is doing something that we have no idea how to program a computer to do.
Because we're also – I'm sorry.
No, I was just thinking that's a terrific point. It's the things that seem ordinary to us. They seem ordinary because we're so fantastically good at them. It's like breathing. And in fact, they're remarkable abilities.
It's almost as if every time I do these shows, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I haven't – I might not say this correctly because I'm still trying to articulate this idea. But we've been doing these shows for a number of years on brain and the arts, and it's been a while that we've been doing these. So it's almost as if neuroscience is attempting to get at places that we've lost because of the industrialization of society and the complexities we've created and the regimentation we've created in the world that we've lost. We're sort of studying what we've actually lost and trying to find again in some ways.
You know, as you've been talking, I've been trying to think of what's the word, but there is an intimacy about knowing ourselves that I think neuroscience, brain sciences do, which is really quite beautiful and great.
Susan, you have to very quickly tell folks how to get in touch if they want to come, because that's my music in my ear means we're going off the air.
Sure. Go to brainscienceinstitute.org and you can find information there about how to register for the conference.
Thank you so much for being all here. This has been great. Susan Maxam and David Hess. Good to see you again. Ed Connor, David Foster, and Barbara Landau just a little bit earlier. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered today by Brian Boone. Our interns are Will Mason, Shari Barnes, Ashley Boddy, and Dookie Lee. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, learn more about what our guests are talking about, you can visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.